Okay, I'll tell you all about Steve Mosier. Yeah, well, he's a hot shot at Wheaton, I know that.
I followed you as president of this wonderful organization.
He did follow me as president of this wonderful organization, which I was very grateful for. And
you're so grateful to hand it over to him.
I definitely was. That is true. Uh-huh. You have a lovely wife. I know that. Been involved in ASA for how many years?
A long time. A couple decades.
Major influence on students at Wheaton, that's for sure. Major influence in the whole world of geology.
All right, well, I hope this will be just kind of a fun story that I'm going to tell you about. If you were at the conference in 2019, it was at Wheaton College, and how many people were there? So, oh man, that's probably why you're here, because you want to know more about the Perimastodon. It was right there in the hall. So I really should have done this talk in 2019, but I actually was busy that year. So I had the opportunity to spend some of my sabbatical time in 2021 to begin to write a book about the Perimastodon. So this is based in part on some of the research I did by reading through many, many documents that are in the college archives and reading many, many newspaper clippings and actually having the opportunity to interview many of the people that were involved in the discovery and the restoration of this particular specimen. And along the way, I hope that we'll learn a little bit about why this mastodon specimen is at a Christian college, where you might wonder, what do people think about a prehistoric and extinct animal being at a Christian college? So that's what we'll be talking about today. So there was this celebrity who lived near Wheaton in a town called Glen Ellen. His name was Joseph Sam Perry, and he was a celebrity because he had been a lawyer in nearby Wheaton for many, many years. He was a Democrat from the South, from Alabama, in a very Republican county. And he did manage to get himself elected to the state assembly, but he was never able to get to any other higher office because he was in such a Republican county. Nevertheless, he was much beloved, and President Truman appointed him to be a federal district court judge for northeastern Illinois. It would have been obviously during Truman's term in the 50s, early 50s. So he had a really nice property on the east side of Glen Ellen, which is now bordering a large forest preserve. But he had a couple of ponds, and he wanted to take these 10 acres or so that he had and make one big pond. So on Wednesday, October 16th, 1963, he had a crew working on his property. There were already some homes being developed around these three ponds, and they were using a big drag line, and they discovered, if you can't see it there, this very large bone. And Marshall Erb had this drag line. He pulled the mud out, you know, because this pond was just, you know, filling with water as they were dredging it, and they had to keep pumping the water out. But he noticed the top of this femur and thought maybe it was a skull. And he went down to the bucket, and he started, you know, digging it out, and it turned out to be this really, really large femur. Well, of course, the judge knew every newspaper editor in northeastern Illinois, and he started calling the local newspapers and radio stations. And it was actually a newspaper reporter who called Wheaton College wanting to know if maybe they could get an expert opinion about what kind of animal it was. And of course, all these guys at the site could think about was dinosaurs, but you know, dinosaurs aren't really found in any rocks or soil in northeastern Illinois. But they really couldn't have called maybe some better experts. One was a biology professor, Cyril Luckman, and the Cyril Luckman then got a geology instructor, Douglas Block, to come out and look at it. And Doug Block actually had some experience in Pleistocene geology. So when they saw the bone, they knew that it was one of those elephants that lived in North America during the Ice Age, during the Pleistocene, but are of course now extinct. And Doug Block got permission from the judge to come back the next day and start digging around. So they ceased the operation of the excavation and allowed him to dig around. And he started finding a lot of bones. So he called the other professor, Boardman, who at first thought it really probably wouldn't amount to much. And they managed to get four or five of the senior geology majors to come out and start digging. And the judge the whole time was paying for the pumps to be keeping the area dry, and the excavators were there to help pull more of the mud out. And I'm sorry the light's a little bright there, but these are some of the only color images we have of the dig. Dr. Boardman was taking a lot of photographs. They're really nice black and white photographs. You'll see some of them. But you can see that it was a really muddy mess in October. And they really only had 4 days of excavation, which is not what a paleontologist would prefer. Of course, you'd like to string it out for weeks and months and do a very careful analysis of where the bones are. But the judge made it clear that he would only be willing to allow for a short period of time. But as you can imagine, since the judge was kind of a celebrity, there were a lot of great newspaper headlines. Judge asked for a bigger lake, gets a course in geology too. This photograph is actually from the Stars and Stripes, so it even made it into the military newspaper, and it was even in a newspaper in London, England. So there, it was quite the event, and the place started filling with people who were coming. There was a high school nearby, and so they would come and watch. So as you can see in the previous slides, there were quite a few people while they were digging. Now, the geology majors I'm highlighting here really went on to have some very distinguished careers in geoscience, which is really cool. Jim Gill became a professor at the University of California, marine volcanology. There's even a seamount named after him. And Galen Lee worked in the area of natural hazards in California, water resources. John Stone went to create his own oil company in the 1980s. Larry Benson became a USGS Great Basin geologist. One of his last papers was curiously on some very, very ancient petroglyphs that might even be older than the Periomastodon. And then Mynek Dirksen, went into library science and was the head librarian at the University of Stanford's Geoscience Library. So these five students really had very distinguished careers after participating this excavation. Well, they determined it was a mastodon once they got the teeth where they could see the difference between a mammoth or a mastodon. And so they found, as you can see here in this photograph, they found the jaw and it was upside down, and they burrowed underneath and they found that it had the kind of bumpy crowns that are on a mastodon tooth as opposed to a mammoth tooth, which is just a flat surface, because mammoths, everybody knows this, right? Mammoths eat woody plants and twigs and roots, and that's mastodons, and then mammoths eat grass, so they're much more like a modern elephant. Here we go. They're very prudent to get the services of someone from the field museum. So Orville Gilpin, who is the chief fossil preparator at the field museum, came out for a day and taught the students how to make plaster jackets for the real fragile bones. And Orville was really a very well known in fossil preparation. He put together the first freestanding mount of a dinosaur. So here's a picture of, and that dinosaur is still on display at the Field Museum, but they've changed the pose because it's a much more realistic pose by modern and anyway contemporary standards. In the very short time that they had to excavate, they recovered about 115 bone fragments. Some of those you could put together into a single bone, and so there are about 92 full bones, which is about 41% of the total number of bones that are in an elephant. And this is just so typical of the judge. He said, some of my detractors in the Democratic Party used to say that I was too much Republican. I guess they did not know how thoroughly I had that elephant buried in my backyard. So you find in just about every newspaper clipping some joke about Perry being a Democrat with an elephant in his backyard. The first restoration started immediately, and it just involved a lot of cleaning. And what they really were amazed at was the fact that the bones were in such great shape. They weren't fossilized. It was still bone material. But they really had been buried in a situation where there wasn't just a very oxygen poor kind of environment, and so there wasn't a lot of water circulation. They were wet, but they were protected from a lot of decomposition. I should have mentioned that the before the dig was over, the judge and Mrs. Perry decided to give the specimen to Wheaton College. And so that was a really incredible opportunity, not only for the students to have the excavate the specimen, but to also be involved in the restoration as well. So the first restoration involved a lot of cleaning, and they also painted the bones with a mixture of shellac and alcohol, grain alcohol, which also made into a lot of the newspaper articles about how they had alcohol at Wheaton College for the first time. So that was kind of a big deal too. And so they would mix the shellac and the alcohol, and then they would paint the bones. And that at the time was the best practice. Now they use another chemical. It also gave the bones kind of a appearance like refinished wood, so it was really kind of interesting. You can see that the tusk here was in very, very poor shape, and in fact, those tusks were never restored until recently. I'll tell you more about that later. Larry King was a pre-med student who was one of Dr. Luckman's mentees, and he recommended that Larry work with Dr. Boardman in identifying all the bones, but they also started experimenting with duplicating missing bones, because we're bilaterally symmetrical, right? So if you had a missing bone from the left side, but you had that bone from the right side, you could basically make like a mirror image of that bone. And so they did that with clay and sculptor's tools, and Larry got to be very good at that. He's also a pretty good artist, and he was able to work one summer, sort of a very early version of sort of a summer working with your science professor, which we do now all the time in at the college. But he was able to visit mastodons at various museums around the Midwest and the Northeast. So Larry's work was really, really crucial, and he came to the conclusion that many of the mastodons that were mounted around the country weren't mounted correctly. And I've been able to talk to him about this. It really warranted some scientific publications, the work that he had done. Well, some of the first science came from a date very early in the history of radiometric dating. It turned out an ASA stalwart, really, and distinguished Wheaton alumni was Lawrence Culp. He was a professor at Columbia University and established one of the first carbon-14 labs. And then he founded a company called Isotopes. And they provided the first date, not of bone material, because back then you had to use a lot of material, but they did have wood that was found with the mastodon. And so they determined that the date was about 10,980 years, plus or minus 350 years. Now this sort of is the origin of kind of, if you've been around Wheaton, you always think about the audio narration that's been with the mastodon for many years. It started some 10,000 years ago. So that's kind of where that came from. What they didn't do back then was calibrate the date. So if you look at the way carbon-14 varies in tree rings and then eventually in lake sediment, you may have talked about that on your field trip this weekend, you have to have a calibration because the amount of carbon-14 being produced in the upper atmosphere isn't constant from year to year. And so if we use the calibration, went backwards again. If you look at the calibration for that date, it actually comes out to be about 13,600 years. So it's actually, 300 years older than 10,000 years ago. And indeed, the mastodons are known to have been extinct by about 12,000 years ago. So 10,000 years really wouldn't make sense from what we understand about Pleistocene extinctions. Anyway, the bones started to go on display. And Dr. Boardman thought it might be interesting to use this new product, fiberglass. So I love that. Fiberglass is in your life for good. See, now we're talking about forever chemicals. I guess that was a little prophetic there. He wrote Pittsburgh, and he wrote Owens Corning and said, hey, do you know anyone who's actually making bones out of fiberglass? And it turned out there was a guy in Chicago who was even making a fossil project using fiberglass. And it turned out that Richard Rush even lived in Glen Ellen, and his daughter was even at the discovery site when it was excavated. So Richard Rush had already distinguished himself as a model maker and created all kinds of fiberglass things, like the famous heart that's in the Science Museum in Chicago, or the Caribbean Reef in the Shedd Aquarium, or even at the Epcot Center later on, and several really important and interesting displays. So Richard Rush took an interest in this and was asked to come up with a proposal to restore the skeleton, and his original proposal from 1969 came up to about $86,000. And the idea was, since there were more bones on the right side, that they would restore. That's wrong. It's the restoration of the left side. That they would restore it only on the left side, and they would make a model of the right side. And so a little bit more on that later. They needed to raise the money for this. As you can see, that's a lot of money. Think about $1969 dollars. Multiply it by about 6.5, I think, to get to the change in costs. And of course, the college was in the midst of a building program, and they didn't want to divert their fundraising to this, and the judge thought that it should be a community effort. So they developed a community committee, and the judge got all of the editors in the Chicago area to write stories about it, and there was this attempt to raise money. And then at this time, there was a plan for a new science building. And of course, the Perimastodon would be featured in the science building. So here's some architectural models of what the Mastodon display would look like. And so you get all of the press to raise the funds. Well, one of the most interesting things I discovered is that there was a bone swap that Richard Rush coordinated with another mastodon that was being built in Pennsylvania. And so there was at one point that it was proposed that bones that were missing from the Marshall's Creek mastodon could be used for the Perry mastodon and vice versa. Also notice the really nice, this is actually how it looks now. There is a full model of the Marshall Creek mastodon. And that was sculpted by a very famous animal sculptor, Louis Paul Jonas, who did all of the dinosaurs at the 1964 World's Fair. Was anybody at the 1964 World's Fair? Come on, so yeah, I was there actually. It was very small, but anyway. Well, actually, we use the same half of that that model is on the Perry mastodon as well. So not only did he do the Marshall Creek's mastodon, he did at least half of the Perry mastodon. Well, Rush needed the money to do this bone swap, and the fundraising wasn't going very well. So the judge loaned $15,000 to get the money for that. And then the new building was finished before the mastodon was even completed. And so there are all these calls for money. And even by 1973, it's still, the fundraising wasn't complete. Finally, the college bites the bullet, decided that they needed to pay for it, but they were going to continue fundraising. And by 1975, it was finally in the building, and Dr. Boardman could pose there with the mastodon. And so they had the dedication. It wasn't paid for yet, but there was another philanthropist who came to the rescue and provided the funds. And since it was so much money, they named the exhibit after him. And then the Perry mastodon became a campus attraction, which it still is. Generally, I give this lecture to 7-year-olds, so this is a real treat for me. Perry mastodon became a campus icon, but not the mascot. Not the mascot. We were the Wheaton Crusaders, and in 2000, we became, and that was offensive to some people, right, to be the Crusaders. So in 2000, we became Thunder, which offends nobody. And however, in 2010, our new president decided that really the mastodon needed to be celebrated. And so he introduced a mascot called Steratoris Tor Thunder. And so now we have this, takes two people to make this thing work. It helps if they're friends. And they go out and do a lot of cool stuff at games. So anyway, this was the mastodon as it appeared, and I'm going to just kind of get to the next part here. Some of you may remember essayist Joseph Bailey, who once wrote, "I think God must have laughed when Wheaton College, not North Central or Elmhurst or the University of Chicago, was presented with the bones of a prehistoric animal." Much more prehistoric than many of Wheaton's constituency would have supposed, discovered in a local peat bog. Well, this has been a really big question. And in fact, the original narration just ended so that we may put the present in context and the future in perspective. It wasn't long after that they even added a little bit of sanctification there and motivate our continued search to see the glory of God in his creation. Well, I'm going to have to rush through a few things here, but what I wanted to make the point is that just the year before the mastodon was discovered, Wheaton had published kind of an essay or a white paper to clarify their stand on origins and science and Christianity. And in that document, the age of the earth was said to be completely ambiguous in terms of the scriptural record, and that there should be no problem with a mastodon being 13,000 years old or 10,000 years old. And also, at least a form of progressive creation was affirmed. And so you see here today, the evidence seems quite strong in favor of the position that many species have been derived from a common ancestor, the specially created kind of Genesis 1. So it was endorsing kind of a version of progressive creation. Now, they did reject theistic evolution, which nowadays people use the term evolutionary creation. And there's a spectrum of ideas about human origins at Wheaton College, as long as the idea of a historic Adam is affirmed. And so the idea of having a fossil specimen at a Christian college, at least as far as Wheaton is concerned, has really never been an issue, even before it was restored and put on display. So I'll stop it there. Thanks.
The mastodon, I believe, is the largest mascot in the whole of the NCAA.
Yes, it is. And that brings up what I was afraid you were going to say, is that it's the largest and most complete mastodon in the world, which for many years that was kind of said. It's the largest and most complete mastodon in the building. It's not anywhere near the largest and most complete in the world. But actually, the judge, I just got a copy of Nell Perry's scrapbook, and he actually had that written down. It's like a talking point. So the judge would go around and tell people that, and it's still around today.
Kind of a science question, but how many such like well-preserved mastodons are there? Are there dozens, thousands?
Well,
I mean, it's relatively recent in geologic history.
Yeah, I can't give you the exact number unless you know it. Do you know it? The exact number of, oh no, you might have another question.
Oh, different question.
Okay, I thought.
Are we talking dozens?
It's less than 100, and in fact, there are more in Illinois than any place in the world. I'm sorry, go ahead.
I was giving you a thumbs up because I wanted to say your question, but I had a second question was, typically where there's smoke, there's fire.
Uh-huh.
And to find the Perry mastodon, were there other efforts in the region to find similar fossils?
Yeah, you know, the interesting thing about mastodons and mammoths is that generally it's luck. You can't go prospecting for them. I mean, they just show up at things like this. They might get exposed during a highway construction, or a river might, you know, a bank might clear out and you find one. But it's just, I don't know of anyone who's really been able to prospect for mammoths or mastodons.
Maybe they were solitary animals?
Well, no, that's a good question, too. That's another one. Dorothy, can I just say our second restoration of the mastodon, where it is in the new building, which I didn't have a chance to talk about, is due to Dorothy's efforts. So,
thank you, Stephen. Enjoyed your talk very much. And I enjoyed living with the mastodon for many years. Yeah. I was just going to mention that it has moved on campus from the old building to the new building.
That's right.
And it is a feature. We designed a space through the building from the third floor all the way down into the lower level that is strictly exhibit space.
Yeah.
And so it's not called a geology museum, but rather a geology exhibition space.
Yeah.
And it goes right on up through the building, so it deals with astronomy, biology, and so on. So
yeah.
And Steve has been a wonderful point person on the geology and other things there. So
thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. All right, well, thank you very much.
Okay, let's thank Steve. Yeah.